That lines the death toll from Monday's two powerful earthquakes in Turkey, and Syria keeps rising as rescue and search operations continue. An extremist Israeli minister pushes for a five-fold increase in gun permits for settlers as the regime escalates its bloody crackdown on Palestinians. And the U.S. president issues a new warning to China as tensions remain high over a Chinese balloon entering American airspace. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half-hour: search and rescue teams continue to look for possible survivors in the piles of rubble in Syria and Turkey as people are struggling to reel from two powerful back-to-back earthquakes. According to official figures, the death toll has risen to more than 6,200 in Turkey and about 2,500 in Syria. The World Health Organization has warned that the number of fatalities could cross 20,000 as freezing weather and aftershocks have slowed rescue efforts. The earthquakes, measuring 7.8 and 7.5 on the Richter scale, struck southeastern Turkey and northern Syria on Monday. The tremors caused hundreds of buildings to collapse in the two countries. The natural disaster left some 50,000 people injured and thousands more displaced. Earlier, we reached out to our correspondent in Istanbul, Rashid Sagnam, to get the latest on the search and rescue operations in the quake-hit Turkish areas.
The rescue missions are still continuing. However, we know that in these disasters, the first 72 hours are very important. And mainly, people can only last under the debris and rubble 72 hours maximum. So we are running out of time. That's why the teams were sent to the disaster area. President Erdogan has called this as the biggest disaster in the era of the Turkish Republic, which is 100 years old. He also said that we have provided 54,000 camps for people who are now without a shelter because the government has forbidden people from going back to their houses in the 10 cities where the earthquakes took place due to the fear of other earthquakes taking the place. There are more than 300 aftermath earthquakes that took place, and they are actually strong. The magnitude is between 4.2 till 7.6, which is really a strong number. It's not easy to control. Also, President Erdogan said that in the coming 3 months, those 10 cities will witness a state of emergency.
Well, our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, also gives us details about the situation in Syria in the aftermath of the devastating quake.
The search and rescue operations continue, and chances are decreasing, unfortunately, for finding those who might be still alive under the rubble over there. We have teams coming from various countries to help and assist the Syrian government in the search and rescue operations. Syria's prime minister also is touring various areas in the northern parts of Syria and in Latakia, touring the shelter, temporary shelter centers established for those who have become displaced as a result of the collapses. The humanitarian aid continues to arrive into Syria, in various parts of Syria. Airplanes are landing in Damascus International Airport, also in the airports of Aleppo and Latakia, coming from various countries, mainly Iran, Russia. Also, humanitarian assistance is coming from Algeria, Libya, the UAE, and Jordan, including, of course, Iraq. Such humanitarian assistance is very important at such times, and despite the fact that they might be not enough compared to the scale of destruction and efforts needed, and the large number of people who have become displaced, but definitely such assistance is very important. Also, very important comments that recently came out from Syria's foreign minister, Dr. Faisal al-Maqdad, in the past 24 hours. He said in a televised interview that all humanitarian assistance is being blocked due to the U.S. sanctions on Syria. And Mr. al-Maqdad said that the U.S. Officials are claiming recently that their sanctions on Syria do not cover humanitarian aid or assistance. And replying to that, Dr. Al-Muqdad said that the U.S. sanctions is blocking everything that might come to Syria.
Iran says a report by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons that blames Syria for a chemical attack relies on unauthorized sources. Iran's ambassador to the UN said the report by an OPCW-affiliated team is politically motivated and based on an illegal mandate. The report supported by the West blames Syria for an alleged chemical attack on the city of Duma in 2018. Amir Saidi Ravani said Syria's information regarding the use of chemical weapons by terrorists has been disregarded by the organization. He said Western countries are manipulating the OPCW mandate to push their political agenda in Syria. He also slammed such states for ignoring Israel's clandestine weapons of mass destruction program. Israel's hawkish minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir, says he will work for a five-fold increase in gun permits for settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Israeli minister has ordered the regime's firearms licensing department to raise the number of monthly permits from about 2,000 to 10,000. Last week, the United Nations warned the move would only lead to more violence and bloodshed in Palestine. Israeli settlers are free to carry pistols across the occupied territories. Recently, regime troops shot and killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy in a raid on the West Bank city of Nablus. The United Nations says the war, says that the year 2022 was the deadliest for Palestinians in the West Bank in 16 years. The Saudi-led aggression against Yemen has left hundreds of thousands of people dead since 2015, creating what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. U.S. President Joe Biden promised to end his country's support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen during his presidential campaign. However, time has proven that Biden's pledge was nothing but bald-faced lies.
One of Joe Biden's promises during his presidential campaign was to immediately move to end all support for the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. In February 2021, Biden stood at a podium at the State Department and proclaimed that the war in Yemen must end. Biden underlined the humanitarian crisis as the key reason the United States withdrew support.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
An investigation by the Government Accountability Office found that the United States is training the Saudi-led coalition and the U.S.'s troops on the ground in Yemen. Biden confirmed that the United States has troops in Yemen in a letter to Congress in June last year. Simply put, he lied to the world when he claimed that the United States was withdrawing U.S. troops for the war in Yemen in 2021. On the contrary, the United States is making billions of dollars from the war in Yemen, as 200,000 have been killed from direct violence. According to data acquired from the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, between 2015 and 2021, the United States sent $54.2 billion in weapons and services to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In addition, the Department of Defense provided $644 million for military training to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, almost entirely through the Foreign Military Sales Program. The DoD uses acquisition and cross-servicing agreements to bill nations for logistical support and items ranging from flying hours, fuel, and bombs. Saudi Arabia paid the United States $157 million in flying hours, and the UAE paid $104 million for flying hours since the Saudi-led intervention began in Yemen in 2015. The United States billed Saudi Arabia and the UAE for $319 million in acquisition and cross-servicing agreements for logistical support. Also, the United States sent $18.6 billion in missiles, $6.2 billion in aircraft, $3.3 billion in ships, and $2.8 billion in military training to attack one of the poorest nations in the world. The United States is well aware that the coalition is not fighting an advanced military in Yemen. Billions of dollars have been spent destroying the country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. The UN Security Council approved a resolution to blockade Yemen since 2015 to prevent arms from flooding the conflict. However, the embargo has only succeeded in starving the Yemenis into famine. On a February 9th phone call in 2022 with the King of Saudi Arabia, Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, Biden assured him that the United States would continue to support the war in Yemen. The phone call came 1 year after Biden lied to the world and announced that the U.S. was withdrawing its support of the war in Yemen. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency's Defense Institute of International Legal Studies conducted training at the Saudi War College that focused on the law of armed conflict, including laws related to air-to-ground targeting in May 2017, April 2018, June 2019, and May 2020. The DoD claims they are not responsible for civilian deaths because they provided the Saudis with training to avoid civilian casualties. According to the Yemen Data Project, over 23,000 Saudi-led coalition airstrikes since March 2015 have led to thousands of civilian casualties.
The U.S. continued backing for Saudi Arabia as a testimony that it doesn't want an end to the war on Yemen. American arms manufacturers keep fueling the crisis as they spend big money on lobbying to be able to sell weapons to the Saudi-led coalition. But at what cost? Lives of innocent civilians.
A Yemeni human rights organization has warned that the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as well as the crippling siege in the impoverished Arab country, could result in the death of thousands of children suffering from cancer. Intisaf, Organization for Women's and Children's Rights, said in a statement on the occasion of World Cancer Day that more than 3,000 Yemeni children who have developed cancer as a result of Saudi aggression and the tight sea, land, and air blockade on the country are now at significant risk of death. The rights group criticized international organizations and other relevant bodies for neglecting Yemeni cancer patients over the past years. Intisaf added that the incidence of leukemia is increasing among Yemeni children, saying the cases of kids suffering from blood cancer have soared from 300 to 700 in the capital Sana'a due to the use of internationally banned weapons supplied by the United States and the United Kingdom and used by Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Approximately 1,000 children are also believed to have contracted leukemia in other Yemeni regions due to the same reasons. The rights organization pointed to the dire shortage of medicine needed for the treatment of patients diagnosed with cancer because of the Saudi-led military onslaught and siege, stating that many children lose their lives as a result. The human rights organization noted that the economic hardships caused by the ongoing military aggression and blockade have prevented minor cancer patients from seeking treatment abroad, calling for the opening of Sana'a International Airport for humanitarian purposes. It finally held Saudi Arabia and its allies fully responsible for all crimes and violations being perpetrated against the Yemeni nation, especially children, urging the international community to bear the legal and humanitarian responsibility for the violations against the civilians. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states, launched a devastating war in Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi. The Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, leaving hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and spawning the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The U.S. president has issued fresh warning to China amid a new controversy between the two countries over a Chinese balloon that recently entered into American airspace.
I'm committed to work with China where we can advance American interests and benefit the world. But make no mistake about it. As we made clear last week, if China threatens our sovereignty, we will act to protect our country, and we did.
Joe Biden's trade came during his annual State of the Union address, Joe Biden's tirade came during his annual State of the Union address. He called for investment in the military, technology, and alliances to take on China, which the U.S. widely views as its chief competitor. The two big economies remain at odds over a host of regional and international issues. Tensions flared up after the U.S. Downing of a Chinese balloon, which Washington claimed was on a spy mission. Beijing slammed as an overreaction. The U.S.'s move saying the balloon was a meteorological and other scientific, was on meteorological and other scientific missions and accidentally strayed into U.S. airspace.
Advance American interests and benefit the world.
Elsewhere, Russia ramped up its winter assault on eastern Ukraine by deploying tens of thousands of freshly mobilized troops to the battlefield. Russia's defense ministry says its forces have inflicted heavy losses on Ukrainian troops, destroying their weaponry in the Donetsk region. More than 30 towns and villages in Kharkiv and 20 communities in Zaporizhia also came under fresh fire. Ukraine says it expects that Russia would broaden its offensive in northeastern and southern areas. However, the Ukraine military claims it has killed more than 100 Russian troops, making the last 24 hours the deadliest for them. Russia, for its part, has released a new figure showing 600 casualties among Ukrainian forces in January. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden in his State of the Union address promised Ukraine's ambassador that Washington would keep supporting Kiev as long as it's required. Well, the U.S. has provided billions of dollars in military aid to bolster Ukrainian forces. Russia has repeatedly warned the West, the U.S. in particular, against arming Ukraine, saying such measures only prolong the war and bring suffering to Ukrainians. It has also criticized U.S. for what it calls news media propaganda coverage. On Tuesday, Russia delivered a message to the U.S. ambassador accusing Washington of spreading fake news regarding Moscow's military operation against Kiev. The Kremlin has threatened to expel the American diplomat involved in subversive activities. This just in breaking news, recent comments from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, where he says Iran's army today is far more revolutionary, faithful, and prepared than before. We'll keep you posted on the recent comments made by Iran's leader and other stories. Elsewhere, Denmark, Germany, and the Netherlands will restore at least 100 Leopard 1 tanks from industry stocks and supply them to Ukraine. Ukraine's armed forces will also receive training, logistical support, spare parts, and an ammunition package within the coming months. Last month, Berlin finally agreed to send the German-made tanks to Ukraine following weeks of pressure from Kiev and its allies. The war in Ukraine began on the 24th of February 2022. Since then, Russia has repeatedly warned Western countries against providing military assistance to Ukraine. Moscow says the aid will only prolong the war. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
There are reports that nearly 1,000 migrant kids separated from families under Trump is still not reunited. Rights advocates have condemned the Biden administration for continuing other anti-immigration policies, including Title 42, under which families are still being separated. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. truth out road in this regard, as some families seek restitution for the suffering caused by former President Donald Trump's family separation policy. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security recently acknowledged that nearly 5 years after the policy was first enforced, 998 children have yet to be reunited with their relatives. On the two-year anniversary of the establishment of President Joe Biden's Interagency Task Force on the Reunification of Families, the DHS said it has reunited more than 600 children who were taken from their families under Trump's so-called zero-tolerance policy, which called for the prosecution of anyone who attempts to cross the U.S.-Mexico border without going through official immigration channels. Many children were reunited through a court process before Biden took office, but of the nearly 4,000 children who were taken from their families and sent to locations across the country with record-keeping about their identities and whereabouts, that was patchwork at best, according to DHS, roughly a quarter of them are still separated. This cruelty happened nearly 5 years ago, said Krish O'Mara, president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, adding, "That's an unimaginably long time for children to go without their parents. This cruelty happened nearly 5 years ago. That's an unimaginably long time for children to go without their parents. Tragically, when they reunite, it often takes even longer to heal from the trauma. Without a doubt, the family separation policy will forever be a stain on the face of the United States of America." Many of the children who were separated arrived at the border from Central American countries, with their parents traveling to the border to seek asylum from violence and conflict. Exercising a protected human right under international and domestic law, the DHS noted that the number of families coming forward to identify themselves as having been forcibly separated continues to grow. Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas said in a statement, "We understand that our critical work is not finished. We remain steadfast in our commitment to fulfill President Biden's pledge to reunify all children who were separated from their families under the zero-tolerance policy to the greatest extent possible, and we continue to work diligently to incorporate the foundational principle of family unity in our policies and operations." The agency is currently in the process of reuniting 148 children with their families and has contacted 183 additional families regarding reunification. Aside from attempting to reunite families, the administration said it is also meeting with recently reunified families to hear directly from them and better understand their experiences and current needs, including support for the trauma the federal government inflicted on them. The day before the DHS made its announcement, Selving Arguta and his son, who is now 21, filed a federal lawsuit seeking monetary damages for the forced separation they suffered in 2018 under the policy. Arguta's son, Selvin Najera, was 16 when they arrived at the border from Guatemala, where they had faced threats from gangs. Arguta was deported while Najera was sent to the detention center, where the lawsuit said he has faced physical and emotional abuse. Father and son were reunited in January 2020 after a federal judge ruled that Arguta's deportation was unlawful. The lawsuit seeks restitution for intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligence, abuse of process, and harboring a minor. Journalist Ahmad Baba said the real-world human impact of the U.S. administration's depravity still reverberates today. Meanwhile, rights advocates have condemned the Biden administration for continuing other anti-immigration policies, including Title 42, under which families are still being separated. The Texas Observer reported in November that between January 2021, when Biden took office, and August 2022, at least 372 cases of family separation were documented by the Biden administration. Though family separation is no longer explicitly used as a weapon in U.S. immigration policy, wrote Erika Byrant at Vera Institute of Justice last June, it is still a horrifying result in the U.S. According to New York Times, also, during the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, the Justice Department began to prosecute all migrants suspected of illegally crossing the border. Those who arrived with children were separated from their kids, who were placed initially in DHS detention centers, then transferred to the Department of Health and Human Services, and later sent throughout the country to live with foster families or relatives. The policy sparked a strong backlash both in the United States and around the world, especially because the administration struggled to track the children. Under pressure, Trump abandoned the policy in June 2019. Soon after, a federal judge blocked the practice and ordered the government to reunite the children with their families. The task force has been working with NGOs and international partners to conduct outreach and support separated families, the DHS said. Families who register online for reunification services are connected with support services through the International Organization for Migration and Service Support in applying for humanitarian parole, arranging travel to the U.S., and accessing behavioral health services after arriving.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's a once-in-a-century disaster that is gut-wrenching to surely make any human shiver due to the depth of the calamity, an earthquake that has taken away so many lives in two countries, Turkey and Syria. Devastation and deaths have occurred in both of those countries, yet one country is receiving more attention and aid, Turkey over Syria. Aren't they both a victim of this natural disaster? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this angle of this horrible incident and why the U.S. and some of its allies, like Israel, have offered to help Syria, even though they have been responsible for the previous devastation through the war on Syria, not to mention sanctions. This is while Israel has continued to bomb Syria.
Search and rescue efforts are underway in Turkey and Syria after two massive earthquakes rattled large swathes of the two neighboring countries and left thousands dead. Rescuers are digging through piles of the rubble to find possible survivors. But the freezing weather conditions is not only hampering rescue operations, but adding misery to those who left injured or homeless. Concerns are particularly high over the situation in Syria. The natural disaster has multiplied the tragedies Syrians have been going through for over a decade. The devastating quake brings to the spotlight how difficult life has been for millions of those who were displaced by foreign-backed militancy and endured Western sanctions. The crippling curbs have devastated Syria's economy to the extent that the country is unable to recover and reconstruct by its own. Now the same unlawful sanctions are complicating international efforts to assist Syrians who have been affected by the latest quakes. The World Health Organization says Syria's humanitarian needs are the highest, describing the situation as a crisis on top of multiple crises.
WHO recognizes Turkey's strong capacity to respond and considers that the main unmet needs may be in Syria in the immediate and midterm.
That assessment is echoed by other UN officials as well as rescue workers on the ground in northern Syria.
Those people already needed assistance. Now they will need more of that assistance, and they need an immediate earthquake-related assistance.
Honestly, the situation is very disastrous. It needs the interference of United Nations organizations and international organizations that are specialized in rescuing, because the situation is very harsh and people are still under the rubble from yesterday.
British activist Vanessa Bealey, who is now in Syria, says the Western sanctions could target anybody who comes to Syria's assistance.
The people who are now homeless are in the streets soaking wet and freezing cold without any alternative shelter and without any electricity, without any heating, without any fuel, because of course we don't have any heating fuel either in the country pretty much. So these shortages combined of course with the Western barbaric sanctions, including the CSAR law that was imposed by the Trump administration, which penalizes any country that even comes to the assistance of Syria. So those countries that can then be sanctioned by default if they come to the aid of Syria, which is, you know, a criminal sanctions regime to impose on any country and quite unprecedented.
Now the Syrian Red Crescent has appealed to Western countries to lift sanctions and provide aid to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The humanitarian organization has also urged the United Nations to facilitate the aid effort, particularly in the militants-held area in northwestern Syria. It says they are ready to deliver relief to those areas if militants open a road for them. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said the quick-hit areas may need years to recover from the destruction. It says long-term help will be needed and not just assistance in search and rescue operation for survivors.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Liza Magnier is a journalist and political analyst who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us, Edward Horrigan, peace activist and former UN peacekeeper, who joins us from Limerick over in Ireland. Gentlemen, welcome. Liza Magnier, I will start with you. And this is a quite a bit of stat in terms of the message it sends, and I'm wondering why this is the way it is. And that's concerning foreign aid, where you have 5,000 deaths, or maybe over that amount at this point, that have died because of the devastating earthquakes in both countries, Turkey and Syria, 3,000 in Turkey, roughly, and 2,000 in Syria. And then you have 65 countries who have pledged aid for Turkey, yet five countries for Syria. What do you think the story is there?
Thank you for having me. Syria has been, since many years, even before the beginning of the war in 2011. And with the Caesar Act that was imposed unilaterally and unlawfully by the US and the EU to cripple the population, in theory, should not include the humanitarian aids. However, as we have seen the case with Cuba, with Iran, with Syria, Venezuela, particularly during the COVID-19 and much before, where humanitarian aids are not excluded from the sanctions that are imposed by the US and the EU. Moreover, there are no countries around the world that dare to challenge the US by sending their plane to Damascus, except a few, like Iran sent 40 to 45 tons of support. Iraq is doing the same. Emirati will send some more, Algeria, Tunisia, and many other countries promised to send support to Syria. However, by seeing 74 nations supporting Turkey and only 5 to 7 countries sending their humanitarian support is something fundamentally wrong, because according to the UN Charter, there are no differences between an enemy or a friend when it comes to natural disaster. So when we see the fake, the hypocrisy, and the double standard of the West talking about human rights, generally speaking, but their behavior in Syria when they see only what's happening in Turkey and try to close an eye about what's happening in Syria is unacceptable, because there are thousands of people under the debris. Syria is not capable of supporting these people in this case of natural disaster. Throughout the war, there were 38 hospitals that were destroyed. 700 doctors have been killed by the jihadists and all the allies of the West that have interfered in Syria. And also the United Nations is now moving. The international, all organization, international organization are not encouraging each other to go to Syria and support the population as they are doing rightly in Turkey. But as you said, there are plus 2,000 people under the debris killed in Syria, and there are much more still when the Syrian government is unable to reach them. There are mass graves that are created on the spot in many villages in Syria in the north, close to Gaziantep. And all this is a catastrophic disaster that humanity is really closing an eye or turning the head and looking the other way.
Well, let me ask you what you think, Edward Horgan, about what the U.S. has said. When it comes to Turkey, the U.S. has said it can count on it for anything that it needs in the aftermath of this quake. In terms of Syria, this is what the U.S. has said, Ned Price. Quote, it would be quite ironic, if not even counterproductive, for us to reach out to a government that has brutalized its people over the course of a dozen years. This is a regime that has never shown any inclination to put the welfare, the well-being, the interests of its people first. I've noticed plenty of scenes, as I'm sure you have, and I'm sure that government spokesperson has seen, including U.S. officials, of children under the rubble in Syria being pulled out, and many to have ended up in hospital beds that have died later on. And yet they come out and they make this type of statement. What do you think about their stance regarding this?
Yeah, I think it's very hypocritical of the U.S., considering what the U.S. and its allies did in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Iraq, and in Syria and Yemen. The sanctions in particular are being imposed primarily by the US and the European Union. Sanctions imposed in circumstances like this kill people. I would call immediately for all sanctions on Syria to be removed, and for all countries to give as much aid as possible to Turkey and a similar amount to Syria. I visited Aleppo with an Irish peace group in 2017. I saw the devastation that had been caused in Aleppo then. Clearly, a large area of northwestern Syria had been very severely damaged, and humanitarian emergency needs to be addressed. So very clearly, the sanctions imposed by the US, European Union and others are now causing very severe damage. Also, the US is at the moment in illegal occupation of part of northeastern Syria. It has at least 900 troops. Likewise, Turkey is also illegally occupying part of northwestern Syria. These countries shouldn't be interfering directly in Syria. And now, in the middle of this crisis, it's vital that a huge amount of humanitarian effort is needed, not only in Turkey, but equally in Syria.
The war on Syria that has lasted, even to this day, really, in a sense, Elijah Magnier, needs to be put into perspective when it comes to the way that it's dealing with this devastation through the earthquake and what it has done. And one personal recount here is how a Syrian was found dead in his bed. This is a person that's recounting this. A Syrian was found dead in his bed this past winter because he had no heating. Why? Because U.S. sanctions are hurting ordinary people rather than Bashar al-Assad's government, because there's only an hour or so of electricity per day. This war has reduced this country to such a low level of infrastructure capacity that it's dealing with this type of situation. Surely, when this earthquake hit, as we're speaking, there are patients arriving at the hospitals that don't have the machinery, nor the equipment, nor the medicine, because of sanctions, and also because of the war devastation, to deal with people. Again, these are all knock-on effects, which ultimately leads to people dying. Isn't that a one way of looking at what has happened to Syria in the lens of this earthquake?
Yes.
Well, we know from...
This President, is for Elijah Magnier. I'm sorry, Edward. I'll get to you in a minute. Go ahead, Elijah.
We know from President Joe Biden himself when he said sanctions are not made to change the government. They made to attack the well-being of the population. Such a statement made by Joe Biden directed to Russia can be directed to Cuba, to Iran, 43 years under sanctions, to Venezuela, to Syria, to Lebanon, to the Palestinians. All these people who have been under harsh U.S. sanctions because they don't accept the U.S. terms and they do not submit to the U.S. hegemony, according to the U.S. understanding of human rights, the U.S. is not looking after the population. On the contrary, it's seriously contributing in the killing of the population. When there is 1 hour of electricity in Syria, 2 hours in Lebanon, it's because in Syria it's only Iran is feeding the country with oil, while the Americans are stealing the oil in the north. And I'm not inventing anything. It's President Donald Trump who said, I want to take the Syrian oil. And then Joe Biden just followed exactly the same policy as Donald Trump, which means that the objective is to cripple the Syrian government, to cripple the Syrian population, to starve the Syrian population, exactly what they are doing in Yemen too. And they really don't care. The end result for them is all justify these people submit their lure, or they have to suffer. This is what Mike Pompeo said about the Iranian. They want to eat, they have to come to the U.S. So what's happening in Syria is that been going on for the last 3-4 years, and that, if we don't count all the years of war that was waged against the Syrian government to create a failed state and allow the jihadists to take over the country, because for the U.S. and the West and NATO, the jihadists are more preferable to be in the Levant rather than President Assad and the Syrian who voted for the president. So it is obvious that the West is watching the Syrian dying, and they really can't be careless about it, because their objective is completely different, is not related to the human right, and is not related to the well-being of the population.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Edward Horgan, when you take a look at, first of all, why is Syria still under sanctions? Isn't that war supposed to be over in a sense? I mean, what is the U.S. trying to achieve when it has already done what it did a few years back, the most severe sanctions being the Caesar Act that it leveled against the country, which means nobody can get close to the country to do any type of trade? That's not even working. You even have U.S. allies who are now back in the game with Syria and the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, like the UAE, like even the Arab League that's opening itself up, like Jordan, and other Arab countries that are possibly in the works to get back together with Syria again. So that puts into question what the U.S. is after.
Yes, the sanctions are having the most devastating effect, in particular on the most vulnerable people, the children and the elderly and those who are already ill. So this, it's vital that the sanctions be removed as quickly as possible, and that as much aid is sent into Syria, into all parts of Syria. Probably the largest area affected is the both the city and the province of Aleppo, and areas controlled by the Syrian government. And it's very likely that the sanctions will prevent much of the aid from getting to the people who need it most. Sanctions kill people, and especially in Syria, and many more people will die because of the sanctions, in addition to the devastation that has been caused by the earthquakes. So it's vital that the sanctions be removed as quickly as possible. Also, only the United Nations should be allowed to impose sanctions. Arguably, the sanctions imposed by the US and the European Union are in contravention of international law because of the damage they are causing and the people they are killing.
There's a provision that the UN has that I'm almost sure that you're familiar with this, Elijah Magnier. It's called R2P, the right to protect. And that was what NATO used, in essence, when it attacked Libya, because it accused the Libyan government pretty much violating the rights of the people of Libya. And that was the basis, which we saw how that turned out. Now, is it correct to analyze and then compare that being law by the UN for there to be a motion towards what is happening now to remove these harsh sanctions, which are in essence killing Syrians? And now we're seeing that a natural disaster like an earthquake has compounded the deaths of people. In a sense, it's just like what the R2P sounds like, the right to protect. The Syrians need that. Can there be any motion towards that on the international arena?
Yeah, and then when NATO, when the United Nations agreed on the resolution, it was very specifically stating that it is to the protection of the civilians. The problem is the United Nations can issue any law or any resolution, but then it is interpreted completely differently by the people and the countries who want to wage war and want to change and interpret the resolution in the way they want. And this is what happened in Libya. So we have to really look carefully and not overestimate what the United Nations resolutions are, because in the matter of Palestine, there are 178 resolutions that have never been respected. Therefore, the United Nations is no longer a viable body, international body that is respected. It is just a building with so many employees. But at the end of the day, who is falling back to the United Nations? The war in Iraq was not agreed by the United Nations and was against the United Nations. It was an illegal war. the sanctions against Syria are unilateral sanctions by the EU and the US. The sanction against Iran is only US sanctions, but who dares to violate these sanctions without the fear of paying the price and then be also sanctioned by the US? So it's a jungle law. We don't have a United Nations. We should really forget about what the United Nations are capable of, because they're not capable of anything. They are under the control of the West. And when the West is opposed by other superpower nations like Russia and China, then the revolution don't go forward. And then they go to war anyway, and they do whatever they want, and they don't care about the United Nations. So we don't have to look at this international body as a balancing the world and then looking really to the well-being of the nations and where the nations have a say. There is a bully of the world called the United States of America, and is saying, I do things my way, and if you don't accept, you will be sanctioned. This is exactly what Donald Trump said to the German and to the European allies when they refused to follow his policy.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Edward Horgan, peace activist and former UN peacekeeper from Limerick, Ireland. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
فارس و هرمز شانه به شانه سلسله کوه البرز وسعت نام تو وسعت نام خورشید جلوه خاک تو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کلام شیران ایران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Jawad was surrounded by a halo of veneration and glorification, and his eminence was respected highly by all classes of society, whether rich or poor. The people saw in Imam al-Jawad's personality the scope and grandeur of his great fathers, who had carried the torch of guidance and goodness to humanity. However, we find that Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam was so humble that he never paid attention to these manifestations of venerations and glorifications that which he was surrounded by. Instead, His Eminence Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam preferred asceticism and avoided the pleasures of this world.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to you, listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam. As you are well aware, the ninth divinely appointed Imam lived in an era where the Abbasid governmental establishment was ruling over the Muslims. Of course, according to the 12er Imamis, who believe in the 12 divinely appointed successors after the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we say that the governmental establishments that were not established, of course, by the Imams during the era of the Imams, these were illegitimate governments who had usurped the rights of the divinely appointed Imams. So, of course, this includes the Umayyad governmental establishments and the Abbasid governmental establishments. Of course, it was during the Abbasid governmental establishment that the 12th Imam then went into occultation. Now, during the time of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, which was under the caliphate of the Abbasid governmental establishment, we find that there was a lot of chaos among the theological and philosophical thoughts of the Muslims. On one hand, we were witnessing in the Muslim environment and the Muslim community an overall degradation of morality, and we could very easily call it a moral corruption on a very wide scale. On the other hand, we find that many different kinds of philosophical, theological, and even jurisprudential issues and problems were surfacing amongst the Muslims. And so here it seems like everybody had something to say about something, even though they did not have the proper qualifications or credentials to be able to do so. And so many cases, people were saying things that were incorrect. Now, in response to this, we find that Imam Al-Jawad alayhi salam very beautifully says in a conversation with one of the companions, which was probably regarding these kind of different matters that were prevalent in the Muslim society at the time, the divinely appointed Imam says to him that silence is a light. Silence is a nur, it is a light. A very beautiful statement and very interesting, of course, because first and foremost, we realize that light is something that brings you out of darkness, right? One. Two, light is the manifestation or the symbolism for truth and for justice and for good and righteousness. And also light is something that gives you guidance. So we have all these different definitions or these different meanings, explanations of the word light, these different aspects, all of them being positive.